This is the Hashrate Crypto Mining Podcast, your best choice for quality conversations on cryptocurrency mining equipment, spec plays, and relevant news. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the show. Now, here are your hosts, Crypto Chris Walken, Whale Bearman, and the Bitcoin Broski.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Hashrate Crypto Mining Podcast. I am the Bitcoin Broski here today with my co-host Crypto Chris Walken and Whale Bearman. We're joined today by special guest Jameson Lopp. I'm sure most of you already know who Jameson is, and you know he goes without introduction, but we're going to give him one anyway because he deserves it. Jameson is he's a staunch supporter of Bitcoin and a big believer in personal freedoms. He currently serves as the Chief Technology Officer of Casa, and before Casa was also with BitGo. So we're excited to have you on the show, Jameson. Thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Awesome. So, you know, jumping right in, we've talked a lot about this show and having you on and which direction we wanted things to go. I mean, you're incredibly knowledgeable on a lot of topics, and it's awesome to have someone with your depth of knowledge and your experience with us today. Connor, I'm going to kick it over to you. If you want to jump in with some of the questions that you have, then we can just roll from there.
Yeah, so basically we do cover a lot on mining, but one of the very important aspects of mining is security practices. And I think a lot of people, especially when you get set up with mining, if you're newer, it's not as, it's not as much as learning from your mistakes as it was anymore. There's a lot of easy ways to get into mining now, but it leads to more mistakes. So could you kind of go over the best practices as far as security goes, especially in the crypto verse?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated topic. It's funny, regarding mining, I don't have a ton of experience mining. In fact, most of my mining is actually on Bitcoin testnet. A couple of years back, I got a used Antminer S5 and was debating, you know, just having it running in the garage for a while to see how it went, and ended up actually deciding to plug it into the Bitcoin testnet, which while that did not net me any valuable coins, it actually made me a Bitcoin testnet whale. So I love playing around on testnet as a developer and having tens of thousands of fake Bitcoins that I can throw at people, you know, whenever there's other developers in need of getting new applications started up. And in fact, I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but testnet is a crazy place. And one of the reasons I was actually able to get tens of thousands of coins was because testnet has this it's kind of unique difficulty reset rule. And it's actually possible, if you time it right, to reset the difficulty on testnet to one, which means you end up getting like 100 blocks a second for a little while until the difficulty readjusts, and end up with some pretty crazy, like, multi-hundred, if not thousand, block-long reorganizations. But aside from my limited testnet experience, most of my experience in this space is on the security side of things. And working at BitGo for 3 years, I saw a lot of interesting setups and unfortunate mistakes that various enterprises made. And for the past year, I've been working at Casa, which is more on the individual security side, but there's a lot of overlap there. In general, wallet best practices are pretty similar between individual and enterprise use cases. I will say that, like, one of the things that I saw a lot of hobbyist miners screw up was that they were getting payouts on an almost daily basis and would end up with thousands of UTXOs in their wallets that weren't worth very much. And then when they went to go to spend them, they had the unpleasant surprise that a large percentage of their value was going to transaction fees. So this is one of those, I guess, security versus convenience trade-offs you have to make, because you're probably going to be mining through a pool and having to figure out, like, when your payouts are going to come to you, and, you know, essentially when the money is going to go from being in someone else's custody to actually being in your custody. And the more patient you are, the more risk you're willing to take there on the custody side, the more consolidated those outputs will be. And then, of course, you have to ask yourself, well, where am I going to put them? I think most people just use single sig wallets, probably, unfortunately, online hot wallets. And if you really want the best security and robustness, then you're going to need to go on the multi-sig side. But then there's more trade-offs there where you're, once again, going to be paying more transaction fees because these are creating more complex and larger data size transactions. So at the end of the day, I think that someone who's spending a fair amount of time in this space is going to need to have multiple different types of wallets with multiple different security models, and basically have one wallet or several wallets that are not quite as secure, but are more convenient to use on a regular basis. And then ultimately every Bitcoin hodler needs to have their like super duper long-term cold storage vault. That is what I've been spending a lot of my time working on for the past year. And that is where you can get like multiple hardware wallets, multi-sig set up, and have, you know, geographically distributed private keys so that you're not only protected against hackers, but you're also protected against various catastrophes and loss scenarios that could result in you losing enough data that you can no longer spend out your own money.
So bringing up the Bitcoin testnet, what are your thoughts on Veriblock, and did you mess with that at all? Because Veriblock's kind of an issue on Twitter and in the space right now, because a lot of people are thinking that Veriblock is an attack on the Bitcoin network.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky phrase, I guess, is whenever people start calling things attacks. I try to limit my use of the word attack to be something that is like against the nature or the rules of the protocol, something that is trying to like undermine the rules of the Bitcoin protocol. And so if you call certain use cases or certain types of data that's being put into the blockchain as an attack or as spam, I think that is kind of emotional and subjective. If you're paying the fees to put it in the blockchain and you convince the miners to put it in, then there's some economic rationality behind that you're basically outbidding other people if there's any contention for block space. So I have to admit that like I don't know a ton about what Veriblock is actually doing. Like I don't see anybody talking about building things on top of Veriblock, so I don't really know what value there is there. I do know that there is value to using the Bitcoin blockchain as a data anchor, and I've written about that in a variety of different articles. And so, you know, if people are using the thermodynamic security that proof of work is offering for Bitcoin basically being the most expensive blockchain to rewrite the history of, then I'm all for people building on top of that and essentially anchoring other systems into it. Now, are they doing it in the most efficient way possible? It doesn't seem like it from my cursory glance, but this is just another thing where I have to say, if they're not really bringing value into the system, then the economics are going to push out those use cases. And, you know, they've been fairly fortunate that fees have been pretty low for the past 6 months or a year. If that changes, then Veriblock may find themselves in a bit of a pinch and need to justify the value of the system that they've built. I think I saw a random statistic recently that they had spent, was it something like $1 million or maybe even several million dollars worth of transaction fees over the past 6 months? So hopefully they're actually bringing sufficient value to pay for that in the future, because those fees are only going to go up from here.
Yep. So I wanted to circle back to the comments about security. The news that's out lately that a lot of people are talking about is the Quadriga exchange fiasco in Canada. What did you make of all of that? Hearing that, you know, the CEO of the exchange had died suddenly and no one had access to the 140 or 197 or 141 million, I don't remember the exact number, dollars worth of other people's money. How did that read to you?
My first thought was, you know what? This is exactly what could have happened with Mt. Gox. I don't know how familiar you are with the Gox setup, but we learned after Gox crashed and burned that, in fact, Mark Karpeles was the sole owner and holder of all of those cold storage devices and keys. And so I'm actually like, I'm very surprised that he managed to get through this without being physically attacked. And if he had gotten attacked and hurt or killed or whatever, then the Gox fiasco could have actually ended up a lot worse, where there would be no coins that got recovered because they wouldn't have been able to get the cold storage that he found, you know, a few months after. So it's just simple negligence, right? And I think that in Mark's case, he has a little bit more solid ground to stand on, because when he started, the coins were basically worthless, and people weren't prepared for them going up several orders of magnitude. But, you know, with this guy, I don't know how many years Quadriga was actually operating, but, you know, Bitcoin was already pretty big, and I think at least in the hundreds of dollars when they started. Right. So it just sounds like another case of like incompetence and negligence leading to a business operating a fractional reserve and like trying to claw their way back into solvency. And we've seen already that that's a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, going off that, I think a lot of exchanges, even though these things happen, and yes, they are bad for the space, they end up being building blocks for the future. And with security, most of the time, you just learn the hard way the first time. If you're following everything the right way, then there's obviously something new that needs to be implemented. So in this case, I definitely agree. It was just not doing what was required of someone that handles that many coins at one time. And maybe it's just because I've been in the space for a while, but I do not broadcast when I go out to places. And when I do travel internationally, I make sure, you know, there's no way that anything could be extracted from cold storage or else. So I just find it insane that these guys that are running these companies that have millions of dollars and billions of dollars even, aren't running around with like security teams. And I mean, it blows my mind. You see these kidnappers that know that these people, like I think there was a conference in Mexico for Ethereum a few years back when some people were getting kidnapped, I believe. I don't know if that was a rumor or not, but yeah, I mean, that stuff scares the shit out of me.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard a number of stories about that, especially the conference that was happening in Cancun. I forget exactly who it was that was saying this, but there was one group of people who were trying to employ, I think, some former special services, like, you know, former Army Rangers or something, types of personnel to basically be their bodyguards so they could go down there. And that bodyguard company, actually they did a survey basically of the locale and the recent activities that have been going on, and they basically said, you know what, we're not going down there. We advise you not to go down there. We don't want to go down there. You know, there's a lot of like cartel activity in the area, and so they ended up not going to that conference. And I've been to a few other sort of VIP level conferences where there has been actual like armed security, plain clothes around the conference. That really started happening after the last bubble. Before this, you know, crypto was so tiny that we didn't have to worry about anybody even caring enough to try to show up at a conference. And it's unfortunately just the nature of the beast of like being your own bank and if you're walking around and being public about being your own bank, then you have to be ready to actually protect your assets. And so that's part of the reason why I switched from doing enterprise crypto security to individual stuff, because I felt like there was a gap in the market there, and that it's actually going to become more and more important for people as we go through more bubbles, as more people finding themselves basically unexpectedly falling into levels of wealth that they're simply not prepared to handle. And you can actually see historically, in a vast majority of cases, it seems that people who suddenly acquire large amounts of wealth often end up losing it one way or another. And I'm afraid that that is basically going to repeat, but in a new way with this new technology, if we don't have a bunch of people building tools and services to help people secure their own money and really make use of this quote unquote being your own bank, because there's just so many ways that you can screw it up that I think that we're going to find it's more likely that you make a mistake and lose access to your private keys than someone attacks you and takes them from you by force. But that's just, you know, anecdotally what I've seen over the years, and I kind of expect that trend to continue. And I'm also monitoring the physical attack side of things and watching that trend sort of go up and down along with the price and the general mainstream awareness and therefore criminal awareness of this new type of honeypot for physical attackers.
Sure. And, you know, with the work that you're doing at Castle right now, what do you find is the most prevalent problem that you're currently trying to solve?
It's basically getting rid of single points of failure. It's boring old data management and IT practices, really, is what it comes down to. We have gotten to the point in the space now that we have a variety of decent hardware devices that can help you protect your private keys. But if you get, you know, a Trezor ledger and initialize it and go through the setup process, then, you know, the first thing that it says is, you know, here's your 24-word seed, keep this safe. And I think that that phrase is the tip of a huge security nightmare iceberg that gets completely glossed over, because, you know, keeping that seed phrase safe involves a lot of data security, both on the like cryptographic security side and on the robustness of like having multiple redundant geographically distributed backup side. And so, you know, we sat down, we thought about this problem for a long time, and we basically came to the conclusion that we felt like the most user-friendly approach to keeping seeds and private keys safe is to not have users deal with them at all. But rather, if users can just imagine, you know, these tangible handheld devices, basically their Trezors and their ledgers, their mobile phones, whatnot, then it's a lot simpler for an average person to envision, you know, the actual security of a physical thing. So as long as you have these physical things geographically distributed, then we can give you a very high degree of confidence that your private keys can't be stolen, that they will not have a sufficient level of loss that your complete wallet will become inaccessible. So it's really trying to keep the user from shooting themselves in the foot. And I've been writing software for over a decade now, and the user is usually the biggest problem. You know, there's always technical challenges and scaling issues and, you know, tons of complexities in all the different levels of software and network stacks. But at the end of the day, the user manages to create problems that we never even dream of as programmers.
Yeah. Well, and
yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say, I made the joke on Twitter that, you know, we can't have adoption until Nana doesn't have to input her 24, you know, passphrase seed key with her arthritis fingers, you know. And we've all heard the horror stories of people that have tossed out laptops with 10,000 Bitcoin and stuff on there because they haven't backed up their seed keys. So, yeah, the solution that you guys are having at CASA is, you know, it's a very big thing for the space.
Well, and you know, also, I mean, right now, obviously, the system that we have is broken. I think that anyone who's paying attention to the world economic system can see that pretty easily. But one thing that always remains true is that people will give up their freedom for a level of convenience. And it's I think that the one area that I know as definitely the newest person on this podcast, right? I'm of the four of us, I am the newest to crypto, and I'm definitely probably the least tech savvy. So for me, as I've learned and gotten into the space, the areas that have always drawn me in the fastest were those that were the easiest to understand. And for that newest person coming in, there needs to be a level of ease to it. So I think that that's the thing that I'm seeing with Casa that is cool, is it's just, it's easy, and easy is good to an extent, you know? Connor, we were talking really, I know your internet dropped out there for a second, but we were talking about the problems that they're working to solve at Casa. Did you want to jump in? I know you had some questions about Jameson living off the grid and kind of the story behind that. Actually, Jameson, I mean, if you want, what led to that shift? So why did you go from your living situation before to now, kind of removing yourself from the grid and doing things the way you're doing them now?
Well, I mean, I've noticed a number of exponential trends in the Bitcoin space, not just with like the exchange rate and the general level of mainstream awareness, but also with like my presence online, social media, following, and resulting backlash at times due to controversial things that I may say or do. And one of the results of that is it's a very small scale of what, you know, real mainstream celebrities run into, which is basically the celebrity stalker or the deranged person who doesn't really see the line between right and wrong. And so this is just the result of having, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who are listening to me, is that it's inevitable at some point that I say something or do something that will trigger someone. And that someone may be in the like 1% of psychopaths or sociopaths. And I need to now actually worry about the attacks that may come from that type of person. And I am fairly libertarian or anarchist leaning, and it doesn't make sense, I believe, for me to rely upon law enforcement or in general rely upon third parties to protect me from any type of attacks. And so I've tried to take a similar approach on the physical side and the privacy side as I have with my technical security around my crypto private keys, which is that we have to assume that there will be another order of magnitude, like increase in value or order of magnitude increase in level of attacks that happen on you. And so if that is don't mind my dog in the background there. and so if the level of like attacker resources that are going to get thrown at you is increasing by a power of like 10 or several orders of magnitude even, then you can't wait until that happens to make changes. Like, you have to have a level of security, a level of privacy that is an order of magnitude or more than you think is necessary. So it's kind of like the overkill, shock and awe type of approach, I guess. Better safe than sorry. And so as a result, after having the one incident of some idiot calling the police and claiming that I had killed a bunch of people, which ended up, of course, getting my whole neighborhood shut down, I decided that I didn't want that to ever happen again. And while the police assured me that they wouldn't shut down my whole neighborhood and send out the SWAT team without calling me first next time, I figured, you know, that assurance was not quite sufficient to give me peace of mind. And I ended up spending about 6 months and tens of thousands of dollars on attorneys and various legal constructions, which allowed me to then own property that is, you know, publicly registered, but not have my name tied to anything. So I've really changed a lot of aspects of my life just to make sure that whenever I'm in my physical location that I spend most of my time in, that nobody in the general vicinity actually knows who I am. I have proxies for almost everything that I do, not just network proxies, but like human proxies, you know, using lawyers to do various things, using legal entities to do various things, and just keeping my name off of anything. So whenever I'm out in the world using my real name, then it's either because I'm doing something over the internet through various network proxies, or because I'm doing something at a location that is not where I spend much of my time and I'm just doing a quick in and out visit.
So it's interesting. I mean, it comes to a point, right, where it sounds like is this worth it to you? I mean, is this really, I mean, I know as someone like yourself that came in this space and you saw the opportunity here, not only financially, but the revolution side of things. And that's probably more of why you got involved in it. And it wasn't about money in the beginning. You know, is this really what you thought would happen? I mean, it's at this point, it's almost like, it's like your whole life now is changed. And did it change for the better in your opinion? Or do you think, you know what, maybe I should have never made public of my roles and I should have just 100% remained Anon?
From a personal standpoint, it would have been much easier and I guess safer if I had simply, you know, bought my crypto, put it on a cold storage setup and gone about my life. But you're correct that really my life has pivoted and become really focused on this. I would say, like, when I went full time into the Bitcoin space 4 years ago, I had already been doing hobbyist side projects for a few years. And that led me to realize that I was, I guess, gaining a lot more from that. I was getting more satisfaction from working on those side projects than I was on my day job, which was working for email marketing software, doing back-end data analysis, which is actually kind of ironic because I was basically anti-privacy before. I was like stripping people's privacy away by writing these huge MapReduce jobs running over petabytes and petabytes of data, where I was figuring out like all of these different attributes of people and their online habits so that marketers could sell more shit to them. But now, you know, I go full-time in the Bitcoin space and I feel like I'm actually making a positive difference, where I'm helping people escape the existing banking system. I'm helping people, evade capital controls and basically empowering people in a way that I was not before. And while I've been, you know, focused on Bitcoin and crypto for the past 4 years, it was actually at that time that I decided that I wanted to make my career goal, and basically my life mission, is to help empower people through technology. And so, you know, going down the route of being a cypherpunk and saying, you know, I believe that privacy enhancing technologies are a meaningful way to impact change upon society and in fact improve people's freedom throughout the world, that I felt like that at least today in the early days, doing that through crypto and private key management is the most obvious way of going about it. But even if Bitcoin gets to like full mainstream adoption and I get bored of Bitcoin, then I suspect that I will still remain in the technology space, but perhaps switch to some other sort of privacy or liberty enhancing technology. I'm also a big fan of 3D printed firearms, for example.
Yeah, me as well. I'm a
wait. Hold on. Have you shot one?
No, my 3D printer is not quite high grade enough to do a lower that I would be comfortable putting my hand into. Though I'm also interested in the Ghost Gunner. I've been keeping an eye on that as well. But what was it? There was actually just in the past week or so, someone dropped a full payload of basically yep. every single AR-15 part. And so, like I said, my current 3D printer is kind of crappy, and I'm hoping as that technology continues to improve, then hopefully someday I'll be able to buy a good enough 3D printer for like under $1,000 that could actually, print out any conceivable firearm part.
Yeah. I mean, that just goes hand in hand with the space, and it's insane to me the kind of backlash and the grip that the media has over the population on how that knowledge that is literally just a book, and they don't want people to have that ability. And the fact that they're trying to make it illegal, and it's Cody's taking a lot of flack for that. And I mean, hats off to that guy for doing what he's doing. Followed him throughout this whole ordeal that's been going on, and I mean, yeah, it's crazy. It's not as on the level of what you're doing. He is going through, I can't even imagine his OPSEC, but it's got to be top of the line.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think right now, not to get too far into politics, but for me, at least, as I see the way that the country's shaping up, especially coming into the next 4 to 8 to 12 years, the lack of belief in a person's personal freedoms is troubling. It's unsettling to see kind of the direction that we're heading in, knowing that there's probably not much we can do to stop it at this point in time. There doesn't seem to be enough of an outcry to maintain our freedom. And you can kind of just see with each new generation that's being raised up, less and less of a desire to hang on to control over our information, control over the things that we're able to do for ourselves. I don't know. Do you, when it comes to that and the future outlook, have you thought about, I mean, where we're going from here as a country, what that could all mean, not only for us personally, but for cryptocurrency as a whole?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's very bleak to think about at that level. I don't necessarily believe that any one of us can change the tide, but what we're trying to do at CASA is at least offer some alternatives. And the theory being that if we can make the alternatives somewhere close to being as user-friendly as the extremely convenient, non-privacy preserving options, then hopefully we can at least get a non-negligible number of people using these alternative systems that empower them a bit more. And so, with regard to like the CASA node, for example, like right now that is helping people navigate their way around Bitcoin and Lightning and basically being sovereign with their own private keys and their transactions on those networks. But if you think about it, sovereignty on the internet basically means running your own services for anything. And like, if you wanted the ultimate email sovereignty, for example, you would run your own email server. Now, there's a reason nobody does that, because nobody has really made that very user-friendly. It's extremely convenient for us to use Gmail or some other centralized third party that is spending all of their time working on the intricacies of email management. Like I mentioned earlier, I worked for an email marketing company for 10 years, and like on the back end, it is extremely complicated at the technical level, but also at the non-technical level. There's a lot of like human relationships that actually go on with regard to keeping the emails flowing. And so We do believe that there is a huge opportunity there, especially if we can figure out the crypto side of things and then move on to other services, is to help empower people to hold on to their own data and run their own services on the internet so that they're not trusting third parties. And you know, that could be applied to almost any type of service if you think about it. It's really just going to come down to what do we think are the things that are going to be most impactful or and are going to be most feasible for us to implement.
Actually, going off the email server, I did see a new, I think it's a startup called Helm, and it's a personal email server that you can basically, you know, put it on your desk. Even it's not that big, but it's supposed to be a pretty easy solution for, you know, people that want to do that. And I definitely agree with you. That's one area that a lot of people don't understand how insecure email is. And I think that's a good segue to talk about, you know, 2FA and
Well, Jameson, was there something else that you wanted to add to that point?
Well, it's just what we've already found from shipping out nodes for the past 6 months or so is that sort of you've got the server side infrastructure environment that is what is running most internet works. And there's a big discontinuity. There's a big gap between those two things. It's very difficult to get people to be able to run like internet facing web services that's on their home network. You know, just due to like the complexities of networking in general and the fact that users are not like IT gurus. So that's one of the biggest challenges we've been struggling with. We knew it was going to be tough in the first place of basically deploying hardware into these unknown environments. We've definitely found some very unique home networking environments when users have called in and said, hey, my node's not working, and we have to do a lot of debugging. So that's just part of the learning curve that we're having to scale.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine most people aren't even comfortable opening ports on their network. So, I mean, hands down, you guys made it super easy for me. I was like expecting there to be something that I just maybe was doing wrong and, you know, was going to have to debug. But when I got the Casa node, it was just pretty much plug and play. It synced super fast. That was one of the things that I wasn't looking forward to because I already run a couple nodes already. But yeah, I mean, I wanted to see, you know, how easy it truly was. And it was not hard at all. And I didn't have to do anything that I don't think someone with at least, you know, a decent understanding of how computers work would be able to set one up.
Yeah, so I'm a big privacy coin person. I think, especially with the conversation we just had, there's a lot of leniency towards that. I know you talked a bit on Mimblewimble before the launch, and it was pretty exciting for the mining community. But after the launches of Beam and Grin, what are your thoughts on Mimblewimble now?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a lot of the interest is kind of plateaued at the moment. You know, whenever there's a launch of something, then you have a lot of speculators jumping in, and now it's kind of back to the grind of watching the developers actually make these networks more secure. And so, you know, there have been a few fairly major security flaws that have been found and patched. I mean, pretty standard stuff for anything that's such a new type of protocol that it's almost more surprising that there haven't been any like crazy network-wide failures, at least not that I'm aware of. But it's really going to be like a long-term battle of philosophies and economics, I guess, between Grin and Beam to see which of those get more traction. And you know, I've heard decent arguments for why some people may prefer one to another. I mean, personally, I'm more of a fan of Grin because I feel like it has more of a Bitcoin philosophy to it, whereas Beam seems to have more of a Zcash philosophy to it. But you know, that's the market for you, and we'll see how they keep working out. But I think what would be more interesting, which I've heard a few rumblings about, is like if they can actually get Lightning Network support working, and if you can tie Lightning Network into an extreme privacy coin like that, then it seems to me like that opens up a lot more interesting possibilities, because, you know, Lightning is fairly private in and of itself, but you still have the on-chain privacy issues. You know, when you're opening and closing channels, there's a lot of things that may change on that side as the technology continues to progress, and we see like multi-party channel opens and closes. But ultimately, it seems like the best way to get awesome privacy is actually to jump from one blockchain network to another blockchain network and back around. I'm not a blockchain analysis expert, but as far as I'm aware, unless you're getting a lot of third-party data and able to basically extract data from the points at which people are entering and exiting the blockchain, it's going to be darn near impossible to actually correlate multiple different blockchains and the activity that's going on, if that activity is only happening within the protocol and not happening with some third parties that might be leaking data.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was one that came out recently. It would use XMR to broadcast a Bitcoin transaction. And I was pretty excited about that. I didn't actually test around with it, but I heard some decent things.
Yeah, so it's kind of funny that you brought up your favoring of Grin, because I basically figured that. Me and Connor, we actually had a talk about Mimblewimble, and we were basically comparing Beam and Grin, saying that Beam was much more of the corporate side and Grin being more of the cyberpunk side. But my other question towards you was, so they had the announcement basically of Beam and Litecoin working on something together. I kind of feel that implementing privacy is kind of an inevitable for Bitcoin. So what are your thoughts on the whole Beam Litecoin thing?
I might have actually missed that. Is that, well, so I think I saw something about Litecoin working on implementing confidential transactions. Was that what you're referring to?
Yes, that article was on Medium.
Okay, so they're actually doing that like in conjunction with Beam?
Yep.
Well, more power to them, I guess. I know that like, you know, I think a number of Bitcoiners got triggered by that because, you know, Litecoin was kind of the one that really got segregated witness adoption like out on a production network and kind of showed that a lot of the FUD around it was just FUD. And, you know, confidential transactions on Bitcoin is also another interesting debatable topic, right? Is that it's a substantial protocol change. There are people who have, I guess, issues with what it might mean, like with regard to auditing the entire monetary supply, with regard to bloating the blockchain with larger data size transactions. It seems like there hasn't been too much discussion, at least that I recall, around trying to push that into Bitcoin. But there may be some people who are so against it that they even see Litecoin adopting it as kind of a threat, because they think that then that will be used as an argument of, see, look, it's safe. Litecoin did it. Now Bitcoin can do it too. But yeah, I'm interested to see Litecoin implement it. If anything, of like Litecoin as a production test net for Bitcoin is something that I've felt like has made sense for several years and really proved itself with the whole SegWit thing.
Yeah, that was exactly my thought with the whole, you know, Litecoin being Bitcoin's test net and them possibly implementing the confidential transactions that might spill over to Bitcoin. So yeah, it's interesting to see where that's going to go.
Now, Jameson, aside from Bitcoin, when it comes to and Mimblewimble as well, are there any other coins that you pay any attention to whatsoever? I mean, are you looking at any of the altcoins that are available in trading currently, or is it just kind of a focus on Bitcoin and the Mimblewimble protocol and things that can come from those, or do you is there a broader view of the market that you're taking?
I mean, I mostly pay attention to any privacy enhancing technology. So I also try to pay some attention to Monero and Zcash. At Casa, we have done some research into multisig on Monero and multisig on Zcash. I think the trickier question is around support from hardware devices. It's been a very slow process. So like Monero, I believe late last year finally implemented multisig, though at least the original multisig was only M of M or M of M minus one. They didn't have like the arbitrary M of N that we needed for doing 3 of 5 wallets. But I think that they did recently add that. And now we're looking at hardware support. There's definitely been plenty of demand for that. Now at BitGo, we implemented multisig for Zcash, but only for unshielded transactions, which is basically Bitcoin transactions. So it was easy. I think that doing multisig and shielded transactions is also not been done yet, at least not that I've heard of. So it's complicated. It's like, how do you get privacy and security is the problem. It's like, you know, we have these extreme privacy coins, but they tend not to have the more complex like multisig scripting features that we want to have for ultimate security.
So I guess the last thing that I wanted to cover was more on the Lightning Network side. I love Lightning Network. I think it's something that needs to happen. And like currently, I am on the belief of, the Bitcoin network right now without Lightning is in the future will be kind of like an ACH transfer for a larger transaction, one that you want to know gets confirmed on the network with maybe someone you don't trust, or like I said, with a bigger size order. And the Lightning network is going to be to take the bloat off of the main network with smaller transactions with people who you might already know, or it's an amount of money to where you're not worried about it, you know, I guess not worried about it really losing from transaction. But overall, I can see Lightning Network being something that lets Bitcoin scale to the level that we want it to. But, you know, right now, currently, I mean, I didn't think that it was going to be as complicated as it is right now. Even with Casa, I still feel like we are definitely in the alpha stages of Lightning Network. I think that there is a lot to be said with how easy this is going to be in the future. But right now, I think you guys have done, you know, everything you can to make it as simple. But how long do you think it will take for Lightning Network to really have that adoption, say, where, you know, someone who doesn't understand, you know, necessarily what's happening on the back end can comfortably use it without messing up?
Yeah, I mean that's it's tough to say, because I think the first question that might be more relevant is, do we think that even regular plain old Bitcoin has reached that point yet? And I would say no. Even regular old Bitcoin is still not like mom and pop user friendly, and so the stuff that's happening with Lightning Network is like even more out there and cutting edge and experimental. And, you know, we're running into issues, you know, with the Casa node, for example, of, you know, LND changes that happen. You know, it's still in a state of flux where bugs can get introduced, and some things may start temporarily failing or having unexpected behavior simply because of the pace of development that is happening at that layer. So, you know, it's still reckless to use Lightning Network because, for example, like the backups are not at the level that they need to be to like perfectly reconstitute a Lightning wallet and all of its channels. That is one of the very simple reasons of why it's still very experimental, is because of how easy it is to lose access to your money if you have some sort of hardware failure or something. So, you know, when will any of this technology get to the point that it can really have mainstream adoption? I really wish that it was easy to find more types of discussions like we're having right now, but from 20 years ago with like the internet, right? I wonder what people were speculating back then. There are a few famous examples of, I guess, like the Economist who said, Krugman said that the internet was never going to be like more important than fax machines, or some, you know, very pessimistic views like that. We only really hear the few extreme historical views. I wonder, you know, what was the real general thought around the evolution of the internet? I got on the internet in the late 90s. I was, I guess, doing AOL dial-up and then early days like Time Warner, quote-unquote broadband. I mean, it was still faster than dial-up. But I never really thought about it that much. I just, you know, took whatever was presented to me and started playing around with it. And of course, everyone else around me was looking at me like I was crazy. So I'm kind of used to being in that level of like being on the edge of stuff and having everybody looking at me like I'm crazy. And then maybe like 10, 15 years later, I turn around and they're all doing stuff that, you know, 15 years earlier was considered crazy, but now it's normal. And so with adoption, it seems to be more about just adding more and more layers of abstraction and user friendliness, so that, for example, a lot of people today that they're picking up their smartphones and they're doing their Snapchats and their Facebooks and their WhatsApps and whatnot, and they have no clue of the complexity that is going on under the hood that, you know, those of us in the 90s were dealing with. It's all been abstracted away, and all you have to do is swipe left and you get amazing levels of functionality. So, from that standpoint, I think that a lot of it is going to be reliant upon the user experience engineers and the level of iterating that we can do, where, you know, we've already seen some pretty cool stuff with Lightning come out with like Jewel and other user-friendly wallets for Lightning Network. And we just need to fail more. We need to screw up more and learn from those failures and move forward. And in fact, that's one of my most recent talks that I've been going around and giving, is this kind of 10-year overview of all of the catastrophes that have happened in Bitcoin, all the different ways that people have screwed up and lost millions of dollars over the years, and how each of those screw-ups, you know, while they were catastrophic, at least for one person or for a group of people, it was always localized to an extent. It was never this systemic network-wide catastrophe. And as a sort of collective, we're able to learn from those things and move forward. So as long as we keep experimenting, as long as we keep making mistakes and learning from them, we will get to that point. It's very, very difficult, though, to make predictions when it comes to software. It's difficult to make predictions even when you're like writing a single feature for software, to predict if it's going to take you like one day or a few days or a week or whatever. But then trying to do a prediction of this entire global network and with all the layers of complexity that go on behind that, it becomes, you know, exponentially more difficult to predict how long it will be. But I think that in general, you know, we probably overestimate how much work can get done in the short term, and then we underestimate how much work can get done in the long term, because it does kind of compound over time. So I don't have a specific number for you, but I think that, like, every year that we go forward in this space, when I look back a year or so, I'm usually amazed by how much has been accomplished. So I figure if that continues to be the case, you know, a year from now, we'll look back and say, wow, you know, we got a lot done. Just in 2018, Lightning Network had crazy levels of growth. And I think if that level of growth is sustained, then, you know, it is only a matter of time, a matter of years before we can get to the point where this technology becomes potentially mainstream adopted.
Yeah, I mean, I run my autopilot, and I know that's like just pretty much running around my my node on the most dangerous level right now. So, yeah, that's kind of fun to see it just suck all my active Bitcoin away and open random channels that no one gives me back anything.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's the thing, is like autopilot right now is extremely dumb, naive technology where it's just going out and the algorithm behind it is very random. It's just like randomly opening channels. And a future iteration of autopilot is going to need to be a lot smarter economically to figure out, you know, where are the parts of the network that could have the most improvement by having additional liquidity added to them, and can therefore, you know, get you the most fees by having money routed through you. So there's a lot of interesting, like, network analysis and also economic, like, liquidity analysis that is going to need to happen as the network continues to grow, where, you know, networking in general is not a new thing, but I'm not aware of any comparable type of, like, economic real-time network modeling on this scale that has ever happened before. So that's one of the biggest technical challenges that we're going to have to continue experimenting with and screwing up and learning from if this thing is going to get to, like, global mainstream adoption.
Yeah, I mean, it just goes back to the traveling salesman problem. And, you know, that's something that Lightning Network would definitely, you know, especially with the autopilot, is going to have a hard time getting past. But I was just looking at, I forgot what website it was where you can see all the channels opening and closing, and then they post their fee. I was playing around with that and just, you know, seeing who's most active there and opening channels with them, and then trying to communicate with other people that I know in the community that have Lightning Network, and we open up maximum channels, and then that helps a lot. So I think it's going to be interesting to see the model around Lightning Network and the economics that will come from it, because it's actually a really, really interesting model. Like you said, there's nothing else like it. So I'm excited.
Yeah, and, you know, Jameson, I know as we're wrapping up here, and I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today. What I would really love is if you could let our listeners know, not only how can they find and follow you online, but also what can they do to support your work at Casa?
Well, it's easy to find me if you Google my name. I'm the first result. But you can also just go to my website. It's lopp.net, LOPP.net. I've got all of my educational resources, all of my articles, videos, presentations, whatnot, are archived on there. Probably at least like a year's worth of material if anybody actually wanted to go through all of it. But, you know, at Casa, we just need more adoption so that people can tell us what we're screwing up so that we can fix it and make it better. And we've got we've already got lots of users giving us great feedback, both for our Node product and for our wallet product, and we're just continuing to iterate and try to work our way around some of the complexities, especially with the Lightning Network. I would say one of our biggest challenges that we've had over the past few months is that, unfortunately, a lot of our early adopters are extremely technical users, and they've actually been asking us for extremely technical features and, you know, helping them do stuff under the hood. And we've been pushing back against that. You know, we don't want to overcomplicate the UI and put in a bunch of advanced functionality that would overwhelm the average person. So we're just trying to find the right balance there between giving a person full control over what's happening with their node versus making it an easy to use, a seamless user experience.
Yeah, give me the login for my node.
Yeah, we can definitely give you the login, though, that will void your warranty, because I can tell you that a lot of people who have started messing around on the command line have managed to screw up their node, because basically the Casa node runs like 7 or 8 different Dockerized services. Okay. And what we've actually found is it's very easy for people to like install other software, and then that just screws up the whole networking stack and random things break, and it becomes a real pain for us to diagnose.
All right, I won't do that. Never mind.
Well, guys, is there anything else that you'd like to ask Jameson before we let him go here?
No, not really.
No, all I want to say is people call me a jerk, and Jameson just told you to Google it, so there you go.
Yes. Yes. It's very important. We have all these resources at our fingertips that we just don't take advantage of. But no, Jameson, seriously, thank you so much for taking the time out of your Saturday to spend it with us. We appreciate it. I'm sure our listeners will appreciate it as well. And to our listeners, we are so appreciative that you continue to tune into the Hashrate Crypto Mining Podcast. It is March 9th. This show will be coming out in just over 2 weeks. So until then, you know, we'll be holding down the fort, and we will talk to you guys very soon.
Thanks for tuning in to the Hashrate Crypto Mining Podcast. We would love it if you would subscribe to this show on your preferred podcast platform and leave us a review with your feedback. Also, if you could help us grow the crypto mining community by sending this show to a friend or sharing it on Twitter, that would be epic. Let's grow the mining community and help other people see how much fun it is. And of course, remember to follow us on Twitter at Hashrate. That's H4SHR8. If you want to snag some mining merch or to schedule a consultation with the guys, visit www.hashrate.com. H4SHR8.com.